This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Health and Living segment and it's our Ask a Doctor series. We're back with our monthly open clinic segment where you can ask our doctor any question you want. And today's topic is very interesting because we have answering all your questions, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist. She's also head of the Department of Medicine at University of Malaya Medical Center, Professor Dr. Aida Nurmiha Hilmi. And today we call Dr. Aida on because today's topic, you know, and you can ask anything you want to know about your poo. Absolutely correct. You heard correct. We're going to be talking about your stools, your poo, whatever it is that you want to call it, the stuff that you defecate, whatever you want to call it. Please call us. It's 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome to the show, Dr. Aida. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
What a lovely topic. You know, we've already got questions coming through Twitter as well as WhatsApp. So I'm going to jump into that with, you know, we'll kick off the show with, you know, my question and then we'll go into the rest. What I want to know is, do we underestimate the importance of our poo and what it tells us about our health?
Well, it's hard to say, really, because the truth of the matter is there's a lot of variation in someone's poo. So it's quite a lot of the times you'll find that the stool, or, you know, a nicer way or a medical term for poo, if you like, can actually vary depending on our diet, depending on even exercise can change it, travel, because you have alterations in your gut microbiome. So there are a lot of things. So I think overall, you know, it having variations doesn't mean very much, but when you start seeing things which are very unusual, like, you know, instead of having a normal poo, you start having diarrhea that's chronic. So not just one episode or two, but rather something where you're starting to have diarrhea, you know, every day for, you know, more than a few weeks. When you start having complete constipation, you know, where instead of going, you know, again, people can sometimes go once a day, once in 2 days, 3 days. It all varies from individual. But once you start seeing a real change, a real consistent change, then I think, yes, that is, you know, that can suggest more serious disease.
So it's very much dependent on the individual then. Yes. No two people are the same?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So our first question from Pudding Custard via Twitter is asking, how many times per day is normal?
So that's exactly what I was saying. So actually, it completely varies according to the individual. So the other thing is that, as I said before, there are many factors. So it's not just the diet or your lifestyle and so on and so forth. There's also a genetic component as well, hormonal. So for example, slow transit constipation are people who just have colons, because, well, in order for us to open our bowels, you actually have, your bowels are moving all the time. It's called peristalsis. I'm sure a lot of people are aware of this. And some people, the peristalsis or the movement is a little bit slow. So for these people, a normal bowel movement could be once every, well, it can be even as once a week in severe cases. But for some people, they, you know, their bowel movement is a little bit more increased, in which case they could go sometimes twice to three times a day. But again, the consistency should be normal. They should be formed stools. I think if you start having watery stools, you know, or you know, diarrhea, then I think that would make me a little bit more concerned that it would be something, you know, serious.
Okay, next question. They're coming in very fast.
Wow.
How do you read stool quality? Float, sink, color, smell? What are you looking at?
Oh, wow.
Quality, come on, Dr. Aida.
Gosh, quality. Okay. Well, I never thought about that too deeply. But,
because you know what, I remember being told, oh, if it floats, it's not good. If it sinks, it's all right. If it's, you know, smelly, it's not good. Color, it varies. So is there any truth to any of this?
Well, yes, because if you've got very, well, I think sometimes stools float, okay? Let's just, because you have, you know, some floating stool, I don't think, you know, that means anything necessarily.
Do we know why that happens? Do we know why that happens?
I think it's the composition. So coming back to stools which are unhealthy stools, if you like, that floats, we have a condition which we call steatorrhea. So steatorrhea is when you have very fatty stools. And this occurs when you have a malabsorption or you're not absorbing fat properly. And then what tends to happen is that you have, I mean, this is what I teach my medical students, you have very oily, you know, sometimes diarrhea or loose, and they are difficult to flush away and they float. And these are the things that, you know, suggest that you may be having some sort of malabsorption. But again, I think this is, you know, something that, you know, it doesn't mean that just because, you know, your stool floats sometimes that that means that you have an underlying problem. But if it's a consistent finding, if they're hard to flush away, then it may suggest that, you know, that is a possibility.
Okay. Next question. Why does lactose intolerance sort of affect the stools? Does it mean having, why is it that when you are lactose intolerant, why is it you have tummy aches, diarrhea, after drinking milk and even eating cheese, for an example? Why does that happen?
Lactose intolerance is due to is due to people who don't have the enzyme to absorb lactose. So it's called the lactase deficiency. So in order for us to absorb anything, we have to have enzymes. And I'm sure we learned this from our biology years, you know, in school as well. Amylase, you know, trypsin, the standard enzymes. But one of the enzymes that is found in our small bowel is called lactase. And if you don't have this enzyme or you have a relative deficiency of this enzyme, then you're unable to absorb lactose. So what then happens is the lactose then goes into your large bowel, all right, because it's not being absorbed by our small bowel. And then the bacteria acts on it. So you get a lot of fermentation, and this fermentation then results in a lot of gas. And then, of course, will result in things like abdominal pain and diarrhea as well. So why do people have lactase deficiency? Well, primary lactase deficiency is probably a genetic thing. And Asians are it's more prevalent in Asians, actually, than in Caucasians.
Okay. Is that because milk and dairy is really a huge part of our daily diet going back in time for Asia?
We can postulate that, but I guess it's not.
Can't tell for sure. Okay. Yeah. And I've always wondered, why is it some people are lactose intolerant and some just aren't?
Well, for the reason that I said. So it's a genetic thing, really. Yeah.
Okay.
Just to recap. So you could have a secondary lactose deficiency. In other words, some people, let's say you've had food poisoning for a while. Okay, so then your small bowel is not back to normal. So these people can have what we call a temporary lactose intolerance. In other words, during that time, as their small bowel is recovering, then they are not able to take dairy products. If they have some inflammation of the bowel for whatever reason, then they may have a temporary lactose intolerance. But those who actually have this genetic predisposition of lactase deficiency, then I'm afraid they're always going to be a bit lactose intolerant.
Okay. So, you know, while you were talking about the lactose intolerance, you mentioned something about bloating and gassy. What is healthy and unhealthy when it comes to gas or flatulence?
Again, there's no quantification for it. I guess all of us have got gas.
Right? We can't compete.
It's normal. It's completely normal.
Yeah.
And I guess all of us, if we take too many things that result in gas, then we will all feel discomfort. So, and things that cause gas predominantly is something called FODMAPs. I don't know if you've heard of this, Meera.
No. How do you spell that?
Okay. It's FODMAPS.
Okay.
Okay, it's fermentable. Well, are you ready for this? It's oligodisaccharide, monosaccharide, and phenol. I
think they might be FODMAPs, okay.
Yeah. So these are basically carbohydrates. So again, lactose is one of them. which is not well absorbed by the small bowel. All right, those with lactase deficiency are even more predisposed. But even most of us, if we took a lot of dairy or if we took a lot of these FODMAPs, then we would also get bloating and discomfort and so on and so forth. But in addition to that, there are a group of people who have irritable bowel syndrome. So these patients with irritable bowel syndrome, they also have a sensitivity, if you like. And these patients are less likely to tolerate the gas that is produced from these FODMAPs. And the reason and how they're formed is pretty much how I told you. Basically, they go into the bowel, a large bowel. They're fermented by bacteria, because all of us have got bacteria. And then they produce a lot of this gas.
Okay. And it's the interaction between the bacteria and the FODMAPs.
So you know how people say don't take too much onions, too much garlic? Yeah, those are full of FODMAPs.
Okay.
Dal. But durians are not, so you can have durian. No, I'm kidding.
Dal is a culprit, yeah. Isn't it? Legumes. we have another question here. Hasri is asking, I recently had a fistulectomy, and ever since that procedure, my stool has only been very soft or watery, never hard. And my bowel movements have been frequent when compared to before my procedure. Do I have a reason to be concerned?
Well, I think you should definitely have your... Well, first of all, I need to find out whether or not you've had a colonoscopy. Because I think that you should consider something, a condition called Crohn's disease, because Crohn's disease sometimes can cause inflammation of the bowel and fistula, okay, a perianal fistula. So they occur together. So I think for you, the best is probably to do a colonoscopy and make sure that, you know, that that's excluded. Fistulectomies per se causing diarrhea, I wouldn't have thought so, at least not to my knowledge. But then again, I'm not a surgeon, and so I don't do fistulectomies, but it's not a complication that I'm particularly aware of. But what would concern me is whether or not there will be an underlying other issue as well, like maybe Crohn's disease.
Okay. The next question is, you know, you mentioned about genes and how that affects bowel movement and, you know, lactose intolerance and all of that. Is there gene therapy to help fix some of these issues?
Yeah.
None. Okay. We've not identified.
Actually, they've been marketing lactase. You can get lactase, from a lot of pharmacies. Whether they truly help or not, I suppose theoretically they could. But to actually reverse your genes, we're not there yet.
Okay. All right. Still a long way to go. We're discussing, it's our open clinic, and we're discussing everything you need to know about your stools or even your poo, if for the lack of a better word. Professor Dr. Aida Nurmiha Hilmi, she's a consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist and head of the Department of Medicine from University Medical Center, on the line with us, answering every one of your questions, most of them at least, as long as we can get through it. We'll come back after this and we'll speak to Robert Tan, who's on the line. Coming up next on Health and Living on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Health and Living segment. It's our Ask a Doctor series. It's our monthly open clinic segment, so you can call and ask the doctor any question you want. Today we're discussing your poo, your stools, you know, consistently colour, whether it floats, sinks, lactose intolerance. And we've got tons more coming through. You can call us 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us on BFM Radio. Robert, you have a question for us. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, I understand that stool transplant is used in certain medical treatment. Is it done in your center, in UM?
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you for that.
Actually, it's not done in our center. As far as I know, only one center does it in Kuala Lumpur. So yes, stool transplant, it's called fecal microbiota transplantation, is done for certain conditions. The idea is that if you don't have good microbiome or good guts, bacteria, virus, whatever, that you actually can take the donors, you can take from someone with healthy gut microbiome and actually transplant it to your own bowel. Now, FMT or fecal microbiota transplantation has only been approved by FDA, Food and Drug Administration in the US for Clostridium difficile diarrhea. In other words, this is a special type of infection which can be recurrent, and definitely FMT or fecal transplantation has been licensed for that. It has been looked at for conditions such as inflammatory bowel disease. And those are pretty much the main two that people are looking at the moment. But unfortunately, it's not mainstream at the moment.
Okay. And fecal transplantation, can you, you know, since you mentioned gut microbiome, you just want to go through with us what that actually means?
So gut microbiome is very trendy right now in the world of medicine. It's this idea that, well, we have trillions of microbiome right in our gut. In fact, it basically has been linked to a lot of things, including obesity, Parkinson's, well, Alzheimer's, well, depression, and just about everything you can think of. So the problem is that gut microbiome can be affected by many things as well. Usually we actually form our gut microbiome in childhood. And the things that are thought to influence gut microbiome is what we take during that time. So if you take a lot of fast foods, unhealthy foods, I'm talking about children, and if you take a lot of antibiotics, for example, you know, things like that, then this forms your gut microbiome and that may predict your health in later life. So it's an intriguing concept. And so, as I said before, a lot of people are very, very interested in this in the medical field. But the problem is its application in real life practice is still not there yet. Because taking a course of probiotics, it sounds good, right? Well, let's take a course of probiotics. But what usually happens is that your gut microbiome actually doesn't change that much. So usually what tends to happen is that you take it for a while and you may change your gut microbiome a little bit, but then after that, it just goes back to your original one.
Yeah. And what keeps it going in a good way?
We don't really know. So the thing is that once, as I said before, once you've kind of developed your gut microbiome, in childhood, you tend to keep it.
Yeah. When are the crucial years? Do we know when it's crucial for the development of this healthy gut microbiome? Because it helps with, I know, breastfeeding. It helps with
breastfeeding helps
when
sure.
Normal deliveries, when the child comes through the canal, the mum's canal, and is born in a natural way. So all of that plays a role. But yes, is there a time frame in which that's crucial for the development of this gut microbiome?
I would say probably before the age of 10, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Next question. I have a. Why do I get rather constipated when I take multivitamins?
Okay, so multivitamins are very popular, and everyone and everyone thinks the more you take, the better. But the truth of the matter is, if you take large amounts of anything, you can get all sorts of things, and getting diarrhea, constipation, things like that is not unheard of, I suppose. So I think my take on multivitamins is don't take too much of it. Don't take it unless you need it. And if you don't like one type, I suppose if you really still want to take it, then change it to another brand.
Okay. We have Daryl Wong who's asking, if you are lactose intolerant, what can you do? Does that mean you cannot consume dairy at all, or is it just that?
Well, as I said before, that you do have these lactase enzymes which you can actually purchase. Whether or not they're very effective, what's the data? For us in the medical profession, everything must be accompanied by very clear data. But theoretically, you could take that. It's not to say, because lactase deficiency is actually a spectrum. So some people can actually take none at all, but some people can actually take some. So I think you should know your own body. You will learn with time, I think. You can also try, let's say you can't take one type of cheese, you can always try another type of cheese. You can also try and, modify the amount accordingly. So I don't want to give it, somebody with lactose intolerance a sentence where you say, you know, a life sentence where you say, oh, you'll never be able to take dairy products again. And most likely, everything you eat has a bit of dairy products anyway, you know, even the bread, you know, so they're going to contain some lactose as well, you know, and so on, so forth. Not dairy products, but just lactose. So, yeah. So I think I'm afraid it's individualized. You have to test it out yourself and then work with what's comfortable for you.
Okay. Ethical Monkey on Twitter is asking, is it true your gut health can determine your mood?
Yeah. So this is exactly what I said to you. So the whole thing about gut microbiome is very fashionable at the moment in the medical world. And the idea is that the microbiome that you have can actually, you know, adjust the, can actually play a role in terms of the neurotransmitters in your brain. It can actually affect that. And that, of course, can affect your mood as well. So it has been linked with things like depression.
Okay. Depression, did you say?
Yeah, and other things as well.
Okay.
So the problem is it's how to adjust it. So what can you do about it? That is not so clear.
Okay. So this whole gut microbiome thing is terribly powerful then.
If you believe all the data, then I would say yes, it is.
Yeah. And what we eat is crucial, absolutely crucial.
I think it definitely helps. And face it, most of us don't eat that well. Me included.
Yeah, I mean, like fiber is important, very important, right? And we don't get our daily supply of fiber, in the requirement at least. What is it, 10 grams, 11 grams a day? Yeah, and you know, most of us are unable to fulfill that amount. When you talk about bloating, for an example, you spoke about certain foods. There's another question here about lying down after eating. Does that cause bloating conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, heartburn, for an example? Do all of that contribute to bloating?
Now I have to think about that a little bit. For bloating, I'm not sure, but for acid reflux, for sure, of course. Because, you know, when you're lying down, then what happens is that all of us have got a valve or a sphincter between our stomach and our esophagus, our food pipe. And when you lie down, it's natural for a little bit of acid to go up into the esophagus. We call it physiological reflux. And when you're lying down, then definitely you're more likely to get this physiological reflux, more so if you have gastroesophageal reflux disease, where your valve is very weak, then lying down will definitely make reflux worse. Now, in terms of abdominal bloating, I have to say that I really can't tell you.
Okay. We have another question here from a 40-year-old who says, R.S. Naidu, who says he's diabetic. He's diabetic for about 40 years now and currently immobile and suffers from heart stools. Are there any miracle solutions, Dr. Ida?
I'm afraid not, because unfortunately constipation, although is, I guess you won't consider it a serious condition, a serious medical condition, but it's extremely troublesome. It's extremely distressing. It does affect your quality of life. I totally understand that. But unfortunately, there is no easy solution. There are a lot of laxatives out there, and there are more and more laxatives that are approved all the time. But unfortunately, a lot of people with chronic constipation, especially someone who's, you know, bedbound, who's unable to move, unfortunately, it's about rotating different laxatives in the long term. There won't be anything that's available right now short of that.
Okay. And the long-term use of laxatives, are there side effects from that? I mean, Naidu has been diabetic for 40 years and is probably immobile, you know, recently. But for younger people who are dependent on laxatives, what's your advice?
There's always the fear that long-term laxatives is dangerous for you, but actually it has never been proven, to be honest. I think what tends to happen, though, is that people tend to get tolerant to it. So they tend not to, you know, whatever they try for a while, then after a while it doesn't work as well. So my take on people with constipation or chronic constipation is, well, for the older age group, or if there are alarm features, like I told you, especially bleeding or weight loss, you know, please go and see a doctor for your scope. But for those with normal idiopathic means unknown, slow transit constipation, then I think just take your laxatives as and when you need it. You know, try to minimize the use. Try to use lifestyle modifications as much as possible. So, you know, try to stay active, drink lots of water. These are important trips. Fiber, of course. But then otherwise, you can always take it as and when. And drugs such as lactulose, senna, there are many others out there, actually. You know, bisacodyl, these are all commonly used. Usually, if you use them, you know, for short spans, I don't really think there's a big problem.
Okay. MN Ibrahim is asking, can you become lactose intolerant as you age?
That is a good question and one that I'm not entirely sure, but I suspect you can.
Okay. Yeah. It can kick in any time, I suppose.
Yes, definitely. That's for sure.
Depending.
It can kick in any time.
Okay. We'll come back after this quick market update. Meanwhile, if you have a question, we're discussing your poo or your stools, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you have just joined us, I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. And today is our open clinic where, you know, you can call in and ask the doctor any question you want. Today we have gastroenterologist and hepatologist, also head of the Department of Medicine at University of Malaya Medical Center, Professor Dr. Aida Nurmiha Hilmi, who's on the line with us, helping us answer all your questions related to your stools or, you know, your poo. If, you know, for the lack of a better word, give us a call. It's 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. It's very interesting how your bowel movements, you know, has not just everything to do with your food, but, you know, your genes play a role, your hormones play a role. It's really quite interesting. It's so complex. It almost feels like a DNA on its own for every individual, isn't it? It's so individualized.
Signature.
Yes, signature, exactly. Definitely. It is signature. There you go. Signature bowel movements. That's what they are. So no one answer is going to, you know, help with everybody's problems. But, you know, I think we're trying to get through some of the things that, you know, possibly you could think about. We have the next question here, which is interesting. You know, you spoke about hormones and how that affects bowel movements, but we've got questions here about menstruation cycles and whether or not that causes diarrhea or loose stools, especially just before or the beginning of the cycle.
Well, it's exactly like what I said. So I think, I don't know about diarrhea. Diarrhea, I think, is not so common, but constipation is pretty common. And that's, you know, we know that, for example, women, pregnant women are prone to constipation. Right? This is not unusual as well. So yes, I mean, young women having bowel abnormalities around the time of their menstrual cycle is not uncommon at all.
Okay, so it is quite normal then. Next question: when does bowel movement actually happen? Does it happen within the last 24 hours of you having your meal, or is it longer?
Okay.
Do you feel like you need to go back to med school now?
Yes, I know, right? okay, so I think. Somebody once described it best as, you know, these little balls like this, balls, you know, on a string, these metal balls, where if you sort of move one, the last one and at the end will move, if you know what I mean,
yes.
Right? It's a transmitted thing. So a lot of people think what they eat, right? And if, let's say, for example, they have an urge to go to the toilet to open their bowel movements, they think that's actually what they ate. But no, that's not true, because it takes many, many hours before the food, you know, goes from your from your stomach to your large bowel. All right. And then what happens is that it can actually be retained in your rectum for a very long time. So again, you know, there is no fixed time for each individual. So we're coming back to the same thing again. But what is normal or physiological is that is something called the gastrocolic reflex. So this is medical school, where basically, I guess, you know, we this is our physiology, you know, we were adapted for this to happen, that when you eat something, right, some people have this urge to go to the toilet.
Yeah, like coffee. Sometimes for some people, yeah, it's coffee in the morning, right?
Correct. Coffee is very good for stimulating your gastrocolic reflex. In fact, some people actually recommend coffee, a bit of coffee for constipation, believe it or not.
Right.
And I think it's natural. I think it's physiological. I suppose we were designed that way in order for us to, well, you know, open our bowels. But make no mistake, it's not what you're eating. It's not what you had for breakfast. You know, it's what's already there in your colon.
Okay. All right. Question. I've been taking some natural fiber supplements twice a week now for a month to clear the bowel tract. Is that a healthy option in the long run?
Yeah, fiber is good. Okay. But here's the downside to fiber. So some fibers can also cause bloating. So this is always a bit of a problem. But if you actually don't have any symptoms like bloating, then no problem. You should have fiber. We already talked about this, how you know, all of us don't take enough fiber. Fiber is definitely good for us because it also encourages regular bowel movement. There's some data, although not so strong, that good, you know, low fiber diet might predispose you to things like colon cancer as well. I mean, it's not very strong. So my take on it is, yeah, definitely.
Okay. I've been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Are there any effective remedies, less fiber, probiotics, natural supplements, multivitamins, any suggestions?
Irritable bowel syndrome is a spectrum of a disorder. So you can actually have irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea. You could have irritable bowel syndrome with constipation. You could have irritable bowel syndrome where sometimes you have diarrhea, sometimes you have constipation. And it's pretty much what I said before, where you actually have this sensitivity, if you like, of the gut. So somebody with irritable bowel syndrome is going to feel gas, which might be normal in someone without irritable bowel syndrome, a lot more, you know, than someone, you know, who doesn't. So unfortunately, there's no cure for it. There's not going to be a magic treatment that's suddenly going to make your irritable bowel syndrome go. But coming back to this thing about the sensitivity, that's why the big thing now is a low FODMAPs diet. So essentially, you can go online, you can Google it, and actually you can actually have their menus, their low FODMAPs menus out there that you could actually do. But of course, the best way probably is a dietitian, where you can actually try and cut down these things that can cause your symptoms. So that's one way. And then the rest, I'm afraid, is just a combination of drugs that will improve your predominant symptoms. So if your predominant symptom is bloating, for sure, I would recommend low FODMAPs as the main thing. But if you have a lot of diarrhea, then maybe probiotics would help. Sometimes a short course of antibiotics, non-absorbable antibiotics like rifaximin might help. If you have, and of course, if that doesn't work, you can use antidiarrheals as well in the short term. So that's if you've got diarrhea, if you've got constipation, then it's back to what we were saying just now.
Okay. And what about eating spicy food over the long term?
Yeah.
Does that cause a damage to the GI tract? Or I'd be gone. You know, I've been eating curry ever since I can remember.
No, I don't think there's any evidence that eating spicy food causes damage to your GI tract. But the problem is that, well, I guess if you did, you'd have to eat a lot. No, generally, I would say not. But the problem, again, is that patients with irritable bowel syndrome are just so sensitive to anything. You know, coffee is one of them as well. Okay, so a lot of patients with IBS are also intolerant to having coffee. The FODMAPs, as I've said before, and spicy foods, of course.
And IBS, Dr. Haider, has a strong link to stress, doesn't it?
Definitely.
So then would you say controlling the stress would help rather than the food? Or I don't know, does it take both?
It takes both. I mean, stress, the way I see it with irritable bowel syndrome or functional dyspepsia is that probably the predominant thing is not just because you're stressed, you get IBS. But what happens is that it becomes a vicious cycle, because we all know that I'm sure you've heard of this, or you may have heard of it, something called the gut-brain axis.
Yes.
Where basically, you know, your brain, of course, is very much responsible for, you know, the nerve stimulation in your gut and so on and so forth. And what happens is, and I think we all know this, if we're anxious for an exam, right?
Yes.
Then you might get diarrhea.
Yep.
So it's pretty powerful. And what I find with my IBS patients is that I'm not saying the predominant problem is that they're anxious or that they're stressed, but what then happens is they become anxious about it and they become stressed about it, and then it becomes a self-perpetuating problem. So I definitely think by taking a little step back, you know, by thinking of relaxation or mindfulness techniques and, you know, and trying to reduce stress, it definitely would help. You cannot cure it, but you definitely should improve the symptoms.
Can control it.
Yeah. Okay. And in fact, one of the treatments for IBS is anti-anxiety medications.
Okay. So that's separate altogether to get it treated for anxiety and stuff like that. Let's talk about the magic word. You know, I know most doctors absolutely don't want to hear is the word detox. Do detox diet actually work? Are they advisable? What do you think? I mean, there's so much out there, from colonic irrigation to fruit juice detoxes and, I don't know, teas and, I don't know, cleansers. And what are your thoughts on those?
Well, I'm a doctor, so I'm not going to recommend detox medications. I don't think there's any evidence for it. I think the evidence
Maybe we should talk about what that actually does. What does it do? Doing, say, for an example, I do a fruit juice detox for 7 days. What do you think that's actually doing to me? Fruit and vegetable juice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know is the answer to that, because as I said before, I don't really believe in detox. But I guess if you're taking healthy things, that's never a bad thing, right? Because as I said before, a lot of us take a lot of bad food. So, you know, I think I would consider it as part of healthy diet stroke fasting or a semi-fasting sort of situation. Mm-hmm. That's for that form of detox, which, you know, intermittent fasting or along those lines have been shown to be some benefit. And of course, fruits and vegetables have their vitamins, you know, and so on and so forth. But I mean, theoretically, that would be the, you know, one benefit, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. So,
but it's not something I would recommend.
No. Okay. So no detox. Why do you say no detox? Because it happens naturally. Is that why you're saying don't bother, or it doesn't work?
I think like a lot of these things, if you do all the right things, and everyone knows what all the right things are.
And most of us don't do all the right things.
Most of us don't do it. And I think I brought this up before at one sessions in BFM in the past when we're talking about complementary alternative medicines. A lot of people want a quick fix. They don't want to not eat, you know, all the unhealthy things. They don't want to stop smoking. They don't want to have a sedentary lifestyle where they're watching TV instead of exercising. So what they do instead is they then say, oh, I'm just going to detox myself. I'm just going to take some supplement that's going to make it all go away. But the truth of the matter is the alternative has not changed in the last, you know, centuries or so. It's just all the right things, eating healthily, you know, exercising and so on and so forth. And the problem is none of us really want to do that.
Okay. Sure. We have Lynn on the line. Lynn, you have a question.
Yes. Hi. Dr. Alda.
Hello.
Lynn here, yeah? Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I can hear you.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a long-standing issue that I really, at my wit's end, don't know how to solve it. Okay. I'm not a vegetarian, but I eat less meat. I focus on my eating. Yeah, mostly home cooked meal.
Okay.
I eat mostly organic vegetables. Even though I eat, like, for example, sari, well cut, parsley, anything, in the porridge or stir fry, but I always, quite frequently have undigested food, loose stool. Even though not loose stool, it has undigested food floating in my stool, because I have a habit of looking at my stool.
You're not the only one, so don't worry. Okay. So is it
my DIY of first line medical check lah, for free. Yeah.
Okay. Is it mostly green leafy veg, or is it any other type of food floating as well?
Most of it. But I realized something. If I eat meat, I don't have that problem.
Yeah.
But when I eat meat, usually it's well cooked. Like I don't eat half cooked or, you know. But I eat meat less, you see.
Okay.
But mainly are vegetables. But then, even though for those vegetables, I don't eat a lot at one go, a variety. Usually I go for carrots, parsley, things like that. And those leafy vegetables, they are not very strong or hard to digest fiber, no?
Okay.
And I cut it to like half an inch. So I was stretching my head, you know.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Ida?
Well, maybe stop looking.
But we need to monitor, Dr. Ida.
I'm contradicting myself. Well, actually, it's normal for these things not to be digested, actually. That's the whole point of fiber. We want it to be undigested and form, you know, and actually bulk up our stool so that it's easier to pass out. And you probably, because you eat such a lot of vegetables, that's probably why you're seeing some of these undigested vegetables. It's no problem. You don't have to worry about that at all. I mean, if you actually had, some sort of malabsorption, that would be completely different. You'd be losing weight, you know, you'd be unwell. But if you're just seeing some undigested vegetables, I don't think it's a big deal.
Okay. What's your message, Dr. Ida, on our stools or our poo and, you know, a takeaway that, you know, we should all be aware of or keep at the back of our minds?
Take home message. Okay. I don't know. I didn't think of this, actually. I would just say, we are our gut. Or we are what we eat. So to some degree, of course. And I think just try to eat well, really.
Yeah. Eat well. Eat well. Try and eat well as much as you can. Thank you very much for joining us today. Professor Dr. Ida Nurmiha Hilmi, consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist, head of the Department of Medicine, University of Malaya Medical Center, in our monthly open clinic segment on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.